KZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. For 6 hours, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche met today with Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime Jeffrey Epstein associate who's serving 20 years in federal prison in Tallahassee. Meanwhile, House Oversight Chair James Comer says the committee is moving quickly on formally issuing a subpoena to the Justice Department calling for the release of the Epstein files. Congressman Pete Sessions of Texas, who also serves on the committee.
We have to, from a legislative perspective, really understand what is it that the government has, the documents, the tapes, who's in control of those.
President Trump visited the Federal Reserve today. The administration says he was checking progress of the building's renovations, and it wasn't about frustration with Powell not lowering interest rates. The FCC approved Skydance's $8 billion acquisition of Paramount Global and its subsidiaries, including CBS. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers coming home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, a good West Coast trip for the Brewers, winning 5 of their 6 games. Yesterday, 17 hits in a 10-2 victory over the Mariners. Bryce Turang went 3 out of 5 with 3 runs batted in. Manager Pat Murphy.
Turang, you know, responded with some hits, a lot of good performances. Ortiz, really good, played good defense, relentless, kind of stayed with it, scored in a bunch of different innings. That's what it takes.
The Brewers at home tomorrow night against the Marlins. NFL, the Packers training camp underway. The players getting their first look at their new state-of-the-art locker room.
Oh, man, I was amazed. Obviously, we, you know, knew all throughout OTAs that they've been building this new locker room and putting a lot of work into it. This is completely different than, obviously, the locker room we were in before, and it's very cool. So very high-tech. You know, everything's very nice in here. So we're definitely blessed to be in here.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love with Sports on Mike Clemens.
We want to help you promote your community event for free. Tell us about your nonprofit group or organization's upcoming event, and we'll help you promote it on the Buzz of the North. Email us the information or a copy of the flyer to community@whsm.com. That's community@whsm.com. You can also drop off your flyer at our office on East 3rd Street in Hayward, or mail it to 16880 W, Highway 63, Hayward, 54843. Hometown Radio Refreshed on 96.9 WBZH.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbaugh Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. The AFL-CIO's got their 2025 executive pay watch report out. And you know what? Our S&P 500 CEOs, they got a raise, about 7%, more than they got last year. How about you? What'd you get? That means that they're pocketing about pretty close to $19 million a year. And their CEO to worker ratio ticked up a little bit, 285 times that of the median worker, up again from last year, which was 268-1. So, yeah, good for them. Also, we find that thanks to the big, beautiful nightmare bill, yeah, they're gonna be able to pocket an extra cool $500,000 a year because of Trump fare. So, yeah, congratulations. In total, the S&P 500 CEOs, they're gonna save about $738 million in income tax. Best democracy money can buy, because after all, they donated huge, big into Donald Trump and the Republicans, and not just the campaigns, but the inauguration as well. The highest paid CEO to with CEO to worker ratio, Starbucks, oddly enough. And you wonder why they're unionizing. A whopping. It blew my mind when I saw the number 6,666 times what the median wage of a Starbucks employee. there's a Satan plus somewhere in there. Their CEO at Starbucks, almost $100 million in compensation in 2024. And what did we get out of the Trump administration? What did we get? Well, their response was pretty clear. We're not going to do anything for you. Their response was, we got the Tulsi Gabbard circus. They drug out and some emails, and basically threw the entire American intelligence community under the bus. Why? So they could score points with Ringmaster Trump. Now, here's the thing. Set the record straight. I don't have time for Beltway games, but I do have ears and I do pay attention, because every time these clowns play this divide and conquer garbage, it's us, it's the working class that ends up paying for it. So what we got Tulsi Gabbard declassifying a couple of documents, spinning some wild tale about Obama and his top advisors manufacturing the Russian interference story, Meanwhile, with the actual facts, which have been proven over and over again through multiple independent investigations, say is, yeah, Russia did it. Absolutely. Full stop. And don't take it from me. Take it from the U.S. intelligence community, which in 2017 said that Putin himself ordered a campaign to help Trump win and torpedo Clinton. That's reality. You had Russian military hackers who broke into the DNC's emails, swiped them, scattered them everywhere. WikiLeaks, DC leaks, you name it. Why? Certainly not to help Hillary Clinton. And look, the FBI indicted a dozen Russian intel officers. We saw Russian trolls creating fake accounts. Hello, Facebook. Ran divisive campaigns, pushed propaganda harder, so hard you couldn't escape it. And we saw it on our Facebook pages. It wasn't just Democrats saying this. It was Republican-led Senate committees. It was the Mueller investigation. Found tons of contacts between Trump's people and Russians. Maybe not enough for Mueller to charge, and he was clear about that. But enough for even the most hard-headed among us to go, I don't know, that doesn't sound right. If you're smart enough to read a time card, you can follow the money and the motive. Russian hackers, they were even in some of our election systems. From what I understand, in every state, they didn't change any votes, or so they say, but not for lack of trying. But the reality is all roads lead back to Moscow and right up to Putin's door. And here comes Russia's gal, Tulsi, dusting off some old emails and meetings, claiming it was all cooked up to hurt Trump, calling it a coup, treason, you know, the works. For a guy who, you gotta ask. Now look, I'm no fan of billionaire politicians or, well, government secret keepers, but to claim Obama and the intelligence community invented Russia's role out of thin air is a pipe dream. Frankly, an insult to anybody who's ever done an honest day's work. We know she's cherry-picking snippets, taking stuff way out of context, and leading hard into that same deep state mumbo-jumbo pushed by Trump and his crew ever since the first leaks hit the news. And, you know, why this makes me mad is because, again, while politicians chase headlines and sling dirt, it's us, regular Americans, liberal, moderate, conservative, who keep getting screwed over. Our jobs disappearing, towns being hollowed out, and we're told, pick a side in scandal du jour. But understand, this isn't just a left-right divide. It's about whether facts mean anything at all, whether evidence means anything at all. And understand, the evidence, the real bipartisan, do your own research kind of evidence, says Russia did this. Russia attacked our democracy. Suggesting otherwise is just another political hustle, of which we've got the ultimate con man in the White House. And it's meant to keep us distracted while the price of eggs, groceries coming down, gas. I thought we were going to solve problems. Things aren't getting fixed. In fact, it appears, if you read what's coming out of this administration, it appears we're going further backward. And the gulf between the haves and the have-nots about to get a whole lot bigger. And what are they doing about it? Well, they left. because they don't want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein, of which you got to go. Seems like a lot of fuss. Ye doth protest too much. So when they come back in a month or so, I say we pick right back up and going, hey, how about doing your freaking jobs? There's a thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Colin Seeberger from the Center for American Progress. Give us some thoughts on the one big, beautiful nightmare. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of emails on the big, beautiful nightmare of a bill. And what's interesting to me is there's a thread on the pro side that I find really kind of interesting. And the comments that I've been getting is that I'm poor pimping. And I'm like, no, I'm just pointing out the reality that a lot of poor people are going to suffer because of the cruelty in this Republican legislation. And it's going to filter down to everyone. It's not going to just be centered on the poor and the downtrodden, you know, the anti-Jesus people in their bill. So I find it interesting that there's that. But interestingly or not, no defense of how it's going to make life better, just that they're okay making things worse. And that's kind of a weird spot for me. And here to share some thoughts on the big nightmare bill, I've asked Colin Seeberger to come talk with us. Colin is the senior advisor for communications there at the Center for American Progress. They got a new piece out, 10 Egregious Things You May Not Know About the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Colin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back on. It's great to chat with you, Rick.
So this is the weirdest thing for me because, look, it's an unpopular bill. You know, the polling is conclusive. Not a lot of people are thrilled with this. Our billionaire friends, they're quite happy with it. But there's this weird kind of defense of, well, you know, those poor people, they should just get jobs. It's a weird kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to contextualize the conversation about this bill in response to kind of a clear message that the American people have been sending for many, many years to Washington, D.C., and that is, you know, the cost of living in this country is out of control. People feel more and more like getting a foothold in the middle class is slipping further and further out of reach, and that the definition of the middle class feels more and more meaningless. And really, this bill just is a direct attack on, working class people in this country by making it more expensive to afford everything from a home to healthcare to groceries to utility bills, really across the board. And it does that all at the same time that it makes, that it gives the very highest earners in this country, the top 1% of payers, taxpayers in this country, $1 trillion more in tax cuts. It's really ridiculous.
It does seem interesting. You know, that whole Robin Hood in reverse thing seems to be playing out right before our very eyes. And interesting, the responses that I've been getting from the supporters have been, you know, that I'm just pimping the poor and just, you know, and instead of going, look, how do we help the poor? instead of kicking them. It's a strange dynamic. But I want to get your thoughts, because this does really impact, you know, vulnerable populations. The cuts to Medicaid are huge. They're real. The cuts to SNAP are big. They're real. You can't deny that. You can't look away from that, or at least I don't think you should.
No, that's exactly right. Donald Trump and Republicans are now working hard to try to brand this big, beautiful bill as somehow, a working class family's tax break, because it does things like offer, no tax on tips or overtime for a couple of years. Yet, when you look at that in the context of what they've done in this bill, not only at the fact that there's only a couple percent of workers in this country who even earn tipped income, but when you look at juxtaposing any sort of net gain that they would get from those tax benefits for no tax on tips or no tax on income, they are dwarfed by the cuts to Medicaid, allowing the enhanced premium tax credits for if you buy insurance in the ACA marketplaces, the cuts to food assistance that are going to take $150 a month away from families who end up seeing their SNAP benefits cut. Any sort of net gain is so dwarfed by the thousands of dollars more that working class people are going to have to foot the bill for in order to pay for healthcare, in order to pay for food. It's just, their argument just doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
No, I go back to some of the arguments that, some of my red hat friends have made over the years about, you just want to redistribute wealth and you want socialism. And I look at this is socialism for the rich. We're literally taking from the poor and giving to the folks who really don't need it, and massively redistributing wealth from those who work for a living to, those who the hardest day's labor they do is moving money from one pocket to the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really ideological, Rick, right? It's not even partisan. You said it yourself that the polls show that the American people overwhelmingly oppose this thing. It's got near universal opposition among Democrats. It's got about 2/3 of independents who oppose this thing. And it's even got a solid number of Republicans who think that this bill is no good. It doesn't make any sense to people that we could be blowing up the debt by $3.4 trillion and at the same time leaving working class people worse off, making them pay even more for healthcare, for food, for utilities. It just doesn't make any sense to people.
It doesn't. And the thing is, it's one thing to kick the poor. And there are a lot of people who seem to that seems to be their thing. We'll kick those who are down. But this goes after people on Medicare as well, because doesn't this impose some new out-of-pocket costs and limits on some Medicare programs?
Yeah, so the bill actually blocks the implementation of two Medicare rules that help bring premium and out-of-pocket costs down for low-income Medicare enrollees. And so that's going to end up jacking up their costs. The bill also imposes new out-of-pocket cost-sharing requirements. So think co-pays, basically when you go to the doctor, for people who are earning between 100 and 138% of the federal poverty level. So that's, somebody who's just trying to get by, who's like barely keeping it together, in order to pay their bills. They probably had to take on debt in order to be able to afford the cost of living, given how ridiculously expensive everything is. And now the administration's talking about, this bill as a beautiful bill at the same time that it's making people pay more when they go to the doctor. It's absurd.
Yeah, well, I guess it is a beautiful bill if you're looking at it from the ivory tower. If you're looking down on the unwashed masses and the, the working poor, this is a great bill. If you're looking up, we're getting trickled on. It's just not in the most positive way possible. But I also want to get your thoughts on, I read something about student loan replacement things and stuff like this. How do they go after, people with student loans in this?
Sure. So the Biden administration, you may remember, implemented the most affordable student loan repayment plan in American history. And the Big Beautiful Bill Act not only blocks that repayment plan, but it also implements a sole repayment plan that forces everybody to enter a standard repayment plan so that they are paying their loans off under a more finite period of time. That ends up actually increasing the amount that people owe in many cases for their monthly student loan bills. And so, you know, let's also remember a lot of the folks who are paying student loans right out of the gate when they graduate from college and they're already feeling squeezed by, you know, the high cost of rent, the high cost of their electric bill, the cost of transportation, right? It's these same folks who are already feeling squeezed who very well are going to be the ones who have to pay even more for their student loans at a time they don't have extra money to go around.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're not solving problems. We're just making existing problems worse with this while increasing our deficits and ultimately our debt, and while creating a gulf between the haves and have-nots that's even greater than it already is. So with that statement, you know, because I had someone go, you know, you got to make sure what you're saying is factual. Is that a factual statement? I mean, is that, or am I just being hyperbolic when I say the gulf between the haves and the have-nots is going to get worse because of this?
Oh, sure. I mean, you look at what the analysis is from the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan independent budget analyst chief group on the Hill, and they say that folks in the bottom 40% are actually going to have fewer after-tax resources after this bill than they otherwise would have under current law prior to the Big Beautiful Bill being signed into law. And at the same time, you have those at the top 1% are getting $1 trillion more in tax breaks. It's irrefutable that you know, the folks who are winning under this bill are the ultra-wealthy, while working people really are getting screwed.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm tired of Trump's winning. I'm tired of what Trump defines as winning, because it's not helping me. It's not helping the working class, and it's certainly not helping the country. And also, it's consolidating power. I mean, one of the big things that's frightening to me is the massive amount of funding that we're putting into basically a secret police force in what ICE has become. And I've taken a beating for my comments that I don't necessarily think having ICE, a bunch of guys walking around, running around with masks on and windbreakers, snatching people up in vans, I don't necessarily think that's a great idea for the country. But the fact that that is now the largest law enforcement arm in the entire country, I think that to me, even more frightening than the Medicaid cuts.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's think about this, right? We're pumping $30 billion because of this bill into Trump's unaccountable deportation force. You mentioned the masks. You know, a lot of times these agents are walking around in civilian clothing. They're unidentified, right? And, you know, and we know that in too many instances, we even see U.S. citizens are being detained without a warrant, without being charged. They're being held by Trump's deportation force. And at the same time, you know, we could be, pumping resources into making sure that, you know, pensions for law enforcement officers who work in local, you know, for local police departments are being funded. But instead, we're pumping money into Trump's deportation force, who are hunting people down in blueberry fields, who are working at meatpacking plants. And you want to know why the cost of groceries are going up. If it's not Donald Trump's tariffs on bananas or coffee, which just surged to a record high, you can look to the fact that, you know, we see after the raids that occurred a few weeks ago in agriculture fields in California, 2/3 of the workers in those fields didn't show up.
Yeah, surprising.
And, you know what happens when they don't show up? We have fewer crops. You know what happens when we have fewer crops? There are fewer groceries on the shelves. Not only are there fewer groceries on the shelves, but you're paying a whole heck of a lot more for them too.
Yeah. No, and that's predictable. I mean, This is something that was not well thought out, but it's ideological, and it gets them their headlines and makes some people feel good about themselves without realizing that it affects all of us. And again, our immigration problems, I keep coming back to the fact that Congress has failed to do their job for decades. And it's a political question for us as voters because the polling's fairly clear. People want a pathway to citizenship. They want people to be able to come here like our great-grandparents and great-grandparents did. It's just we've got a Congress that can't seem to get anything done or won't.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think it is a question of just how much people actually want to solve this challenge. I also think that, you know, people want they want a system that people can navigate the process legally, fairly, abide by the rules. And yet, unfortunately, because Congress has failed to get the job done, you know, we are seeing a situation where folks who skip the line, basically, are being, in some cases, prioritized over folks who are playing by the rules. And that's part of what we need to fix in this country. Yeah. We need a system that, provides for more legal pathways for legal immigration. And at the same time, we need to, you know, crack down on some of the, tripwires in the system that are making it perverse and actually incentivizing people to not follow the rules because the rules-based system is so out of whack.
Yeah. No, I mean, when my ancestors came here 100 and some years ago, they just showed up. They didn't wait in line. There was no line. It just showed up. And most of us, you know, that's the reality. I want to go back to your article real quick before I let you go. You said 10 egregious things. We talked about a number of them. What did we miss?
Sure. Yeah, I think a lot of people miss this because the cuts to healthcare are just so severe in this legislation. We're talking about the largest cut to Medicaid in American history. That's, you know, combined with the Affordable Care Act changes, the expiration of the premium tax credits, we're going to see 15 million people lose their health coverage. But we're also going to see Planned Parenthood is defunded under this bill. That is not only going to make it harder for people to get access to the reproductive health care that they need, but it's also going to make it harder to, for hundreds of thousands of women to get access to cancer screenings and preventive care. The bill also includes really dangerous work requirements on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or food stamps that even target, kids who are aging out of foster care. They target people who have children. They target even the homeless and veterans who had previously under bipartisan agreements been carved out from, from some of these rules. And this bill really goes right after those most vulnerable groups. The other thing that I point out is that, Rick, under this bill, Russ Vogt, the same guy who is out there saying that we need less bipartisanship in the appropriations process, the same guy who's, sending these rescissions packages up to Capitol Hill, Congress just gave him basically $100 million blank check under this bill for him to use it how he so pleases. This is an OMB, an Office of Management and Budget, under Russ Vogt's direction, that the Government Accountability Office has said multiple times that they have found that this administration is breaking the law by refusing to spend accordingly to the laws that bipartisan majorities in both the House and Senate had passed into law. And so, do you want a government that basically ignores the judiciary branch, ignores the laws that are passed by Congress, and just says, hey, we here at the White House, we think that we're smarter than the rest of you. We think that we have, sole power in the U.S. government. We're going to do, as we please. And that's basically what Congress just underwrote and turbocharged in giving a blank check for $100 million to Russ Vogt. Said, have fun.
Yeah, I wonder how many pockets that'll line before it gets back to us. Colin, I appreciate the piece. Hope folks will take a look at it over at AmericanProgress.org. 10 egregious things you may not know about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Colin is one of the authors of that. Colin Seeberger, I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much, Rick. Have a good one.
I want to hear your thoughts. You worried about what's coming? Yeah, because the cuts are real. They haven't hit yet. They're coming. And I'm interested to see how rural America is going to take it when hospitals start closing and, well, the bad stuff we've been talking about start hitting at home. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Tonight, a mostly clear sky, but some areas of smoke and some poor air quality. Morning low temperatures will drop to the mid-50s. On Friday, sunshine, a few clouds, areas of smoke as well. High temperatures warming to the low to mid-80s. It's 69 at our studios.
Matt and Air on Air.
Kareen Hendrickson, you mentioned a conversation with Ron Johnson, Kareen, about the need for child care in Wisconsin. How did that go?
I said, why don't you think we should fund? And he goes, I think an elegant solution, it would be for moms like you to stay home so the other moms can go to work. And I said, well, and I shouldn't get paid for that? And he just kind of stared at us. And I said, that tells me all I need to know.
Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a lot of emails from people going, you know, things are really bad. What do we do on, you name what's going on, Medicaid cuts, the ICE raids, the defunding infrastructure, you know, all of the undoing of the Biden agenda, all of the jobs that are going to be lost because of that. You know, what do we do? And I've been pointing people to different groups all around, depending on their interests. And I thought, you know what? Let's talk to a couple of groups over the next several weeks who are doing the good work on the ground, the hard work of organizing and bringing people together to do what I've been saying since election night, finding those solutions that are going to come because of the suffering of their savagery. And out of that, the organizing for the future that's going to make lives better. And here to share some thoughts on her organization, I've asked Anna Lilia Mejia to come talk with us. She's the executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. You can check out their website at populardemocracy.org. Anna Lilia, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show, Rick. I'm excited.
So we're in an interesting time. There are a lot of people who are struggling. There are a lot of people who they're afraid, they're worried, they're angry, and they have nowhere to go, no outlets to go. So how can the Center for Popular Democracy, how can you guys channel, focus, move some of that anger?
Well, again, thank you for having me on, Rick. I will say that you're spot on. I think American families are not only suffering in the moment, but it's very much going to get worse for a lot of our families, especially with the different changes that have taken place or are going to be cemented through this budget reconciliation process and some of this clawback that's happening right now. So you're going to experience, for folks who are already on the margins, on the economic margins, healthcare margins, education margins, they're going to find themselves in even less steady footing. I think that for us as an organization, first and foremost, I'll share that we are a network of 50 organizations across the country that are power building organizations. We don't advocate on behalf of people or send policy proposals on behalf of communities, but we go in and we do grassroots organizing, identifying communities, the issues that are impacting them, and then giving folks the tools in order to affect the kind of change that improve their lives. And so in this moment under a Trump administration, we're working really hard with community organizations to, one, first and foremost, resist the worst of Trump. Right. Although, you know, it seems like members of Congress are kind of like lockstep, there's a lot of work that we could be doing to destabilize the support that the president's agenda is getting in Congress. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying the opportunity is there.
No, and like any organizing, Anna Lilia, the reality is it's hard on the ground, getting the shoe leather on the pavement. It's hard work. But in the long run, and look, we've learned from history that yes, when bad things happen, it's the solutions that come out of this period of organizing, groups like yours, you know, coalescing with other groups, figuring out, hey, absolutely, what direction do we need to go? And I guess that's what sets your group different from other ones, your approach to organizing.
Well, yeah, our main focus is, one, building base, building the kind of civic engagement, political power that can make demands and achieve victories. And it starts at the local level. So we work, as I was sharing, groups that we engage with now, we have them identify where are the levers of power that can be protective at the state and local level. And then we also engage them on pushing a narrative and creating the kind of energy, momentum, or friction to slow down the worst of the Trump's administration or you know, their project as defined as either Project 2025 or their stated goals, like you hear every day coming out of the White House.
Yeah, the stated goals in Project 2025, which again, you know, go back to Tim Walz's comments, you don't write up a playbook unless you plan to use it. And they are most certainly using it. And your big campaign right now, as I understand, is the Defend the 14th campaign, focusing on making sure that we follow the 14th Amendment. Walk me through some of that campaign and what that all entails from your perspective.
Sure. So we often share that our nation at its inception hardwired words of freedom, but reserved them for the wealthy and the connected. And in the founding of our nation, it happened to be landowning white men that were afforded the full protections of our government. And then we had this moment, this transformative moment after the Civil War, in which we said, you know what, these words of freedom, they should belong to everyone. They should belong to folks who don't own land or property. They should belong to entire communities. And over time, we have pulled those words to cover what are marginalized, working class, working poor, or otherwise marginalized communities. And what we have been experiencing over time is, you know, the wealthy and well-connected, as well as the authoritarian, they share a common enemy, and that is democracy. Because when regular people, regular communities take on the big guy or big business or the wealthy or the oligarch or whomever, what we are challenging are the powers that be in order to protect our health, well-being, and our ability to thrive. And I think in this moment, the antidote to what we are seeing, this unholy alliance between the authoritarian, who is desperately trying to keep themselves out of jail and continue to grift, right, continue to extract wealth from the collective, has partnered with oligarchs, with technocrats, who are willing to trade democracy in exchange for less oversight and regulation. And the antidote to that is people power. And so we're knocking on doors 365 days a year. We're already working backwards, frankly, from 2030, because we know that the double-sided pen of redistricting gives them power not only at the state level, but at the federal level. And in order to actually gain power for working class people, we have to disrupt that consolidation of power at every level.
No, and I like the way you frame that. As it's a class war. as opposed to it was about black and white. It really was a class war because, look, you know, poor white people who didn't own land, they couldn't vote either in that original intent that the Scalias of the world want to return to. And we don't hear that enough in our politics.
I think that is, in fact, a barrier that allows our ideological opponents to continue to gain ground, because as long as they make it over difference, racial difference or gender difference, then they are kind of, it's divide and conquer. We have to build, however, a bigger we, a bigger we the people, a bigger we the movement, a bigger we Americans. And I think it really starts with, one, understanding the tensions that exist between, you know, factions within our country who, again, are willing to exchange democracy or even freedom in exchange for shutting up the proletariat, shutting up regular working class people, shutting up the little guy, and kind of removing us from the calculus. I mean, bottom line, we can't, our communities can't win alone. Yeah. We're not going to build the kind of America just organizing Black people or Latinos or new immigrants or any particular group. We have to do it together.
No, absolutely. And this is where the right, this is where corporate America, this is where the wealth class, whoever you want to put as they, this is what they've exploited, the fissures in this country, the things that divide us. And this is what I've been saying to Democrats for the longest time. I'm not a huge James Carville fan, but it's always the economy, stupid. And if we can democratize the economy, make sure that every job pays a living wage with health security, retirement security, and take that empowerment from the workplace into City Hall, I think this is a better place for everyone when that ideal of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness is actually something we're moving towards.
I mean, you know, it's, you mentioned the 14th. I talked a little bit about it just a moment ago, but consider that, you know, in our nation, we have corrupted the idea of personhood and individual voice and political power to the point where we say corporations are people. And as a result, corporations are actually used the benefits enshrined in the 14th Amendment in order to move their very profit-centered, forget people ideology and agenda. They've used it more than human beings, than flesh and bone human beings. And I think in part it's because we, the people, don't fully understand where our rights are derived. And we therefore aren't building the kind of campaigns, either narrative or organizing, to really resist what is happening.
No, well, the 14th Amendment is fairly complicated. I mean, it comes in five sections. It addresses, mm-hmm. you know, different aspects of citizenship, civil rights, representation, governmental responsibilities. It's got a lot of that in there. But what most people focus on is the citizenship thing right now, because you've got Trump running around saying he wants to repeal this or get rid of it and be able to throw people out, you know, who may be a couple of generations here, because I don't actually know what the theory is going after, but, you know, we should be able to throw people out.
I mean, whatever the theory is, the bottom line is a desire to shrink the number of people, impacted people, who have a voice. So by saying, you know what, the children of the undocumented, they have no place in America, even though our Constitution and the 14th Amendment says very clearly all persons, that means it doesn't say all citizens, it doesn't say all children of American citizens, all persons are afforded these sets of rights, whether it's birthright citizenship, due process, or equal protection. And I want every single one of your listeners and viewers to really capture this. Without the protections of the 14th, you are left vulnerable. You are left at the mercy of whomever is in power in that moment to both define what you are allowed to say or do or participate in. And then you have no recourse in order to challenge what may be unlawful or wrong. So I think at this point, where we are at is a deep a deep need for not only us to our Americans to return to a deeper understanding, civic education, political education, but we also have to turn back to community and not just speak to those who are in our bubble. It is, I think, you know, I'm sure you, like I, have either neighbors or friends who voted with our ideological opponents. Perhaps you have family members who opted out from participation. This is a moment in which we have to go back into community and really uplift and build this bigger we if we're going to recapture
democracy. Spot on, accurate, and I love the way you put that. But let's talk about this a little bit, because the 14th Amendment is a big one. You know, how does getting rid of this affect people's bodily, women's bodily autonomy, voting rights, equal protection? How does this affect them? And then what are your strategies to defend this? Educate the public, pressure lawmakers, what's the game plan there?
All of it, all of the above. I think we begin with an education campaign. We have been working with members of Congress, with thought leaders, with historians to create a public education campaign. Your viewers can check out defendthe14th.org to get additional information. And in fact, you could even sign up to get training around how to talk to other community members about these pivotal rights. The second thing that we're doing is that, you know, you have to build the kind of moment, first awareness and then momentum to defend. There are incredible opportunities for us at the local level when it comes to engaging either mayors, city councils, state legislatures to say a very simple thing. We are going to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the protections that are afforded to us therein. I mean, just starting with that, we know that we could create momentum. The last thing I will say is that there are plenty of theories around grassroots organizing. And one core one is that if you can inject a theory, an idea within a particular threshold within community, if you get folks to act in unison at around 3.5%, you're able to shift entire community. This is based on the work of Erica Chenoweth, who a lot of movement folks are familiar with. They normally apply it to how to resist authoritarian regimes, but it's actually applicable to any campaign. And in this instance, what I believe we really have to focus on is, you know, there's this theory of the Overton window, which is essentially the threshold in which Americans or individuals will accept activity from their government. As long as it falls within that threshold, people will go along to get along. We have to shift that threshold back to what we experience, what was real for us closer to perhaps the late 60s, 70s, most certainly pre-Trump. And that is, we respect the Constitution. We read it and we adhere to it. If it says persons, we agree that persons mean all of us and not just those who are connected or palatable to those in power.
Last question I've got for you. If someone's out there going, hey, I like what Anna Lily has got to say. I like what popular democracy does. How do folks get involved? What do they do? I know you're in, I think, every state across the country, right? There's some affiliate that's part of your umbrella. What do folks do?
Yes. So if you could, well, first of all, I want you to check out popularddemocracy.org. I would say that, and actually I see that you have you could follow us on social media. I will say that our main ask in this moment is first get connected with community. So if you're paying attention to what's happening in the news, let's lose the fear of speaking to folks about our government, our well-being, or politics, because essentially Politics is just the exercise to control the environment in which you must live under, the conditions in which you must live under. So first and foremost, I would say, get involved in your own community, talk to your neighbors, whatever you're reading on in the news, engage other folks on conversation and ask, why do you believe that? What outcomes would do you think you would have that you wouldn't have if there were greater equity in our nation and in our systems? I would also encourage you to get involved in organizations like Popular Democracy. If we have an affiliate in your state, we have actually 50 affiliates in 34 states, Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. So we're not quite all over the country, but in a significant portion. But if we don't have an affiliate in your state, you could still get involved in our national network. You could get trained to be a guardian of democracy. You can receive training around noncompliance and civil disobedience so that you know what actions you could take that could be protective of your community. And honestly, you could contribute to the movement. In this moment, if your listeners aren't at least chipping in the price of a coffee a month, $5 a month to any base building, democracy building organization, then we're losing an opportunity to fund our own protection and our own democracy.
There you go. Anna Lily, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I appreciate the work that you guys do. PopularDemocracy.org, the website. Anna Lily Mejia, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something there that caught your attention, I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the first day of a new U.S. labor partnership, the Alliance for Labor Action. The alliance was forged by the president of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, and the president of the Teamsters Union, Frank Fitzsimmons. The UAW had left the AFL-CIO over differences on how to approach labor organizing. The newly formed alliance with the Teamsters stood as a progressive alternative to the AFL-CIO's approach at the time. The ALA called for forming community unions for the millions of poor and unorganized workers. It supported the civil rights movement, as well as the movement against the war in Vietnam. One of the ALA's slogans was, quote, to find answers to the urgent problems of our society. The ALA developed position papers on a series of issues. One of those urgent problems was health care. The ALA described, quote, the United States is the last remaining industrialized country in the world which does not have a national health insurance plan which would assure all its citizens at least minimum guarantee of access to needed medical care. In 1969, the ALA launched its first major organizing drive in Atlanta, Georgia. The drive targeted multiple industries and included a massive advertising campaign. But the Atlanta business community stood in staunch opposition to the unionization effort. Despite some successes, the Atlanta effort did not garner the hoped-for results. The ALA suffered another blow when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in May of 1970. The alliance disbanded in 1972. Universal health care and many of the other causes championed by the ALA remain unrealized.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I really like what Anna Lilia had to say about the 14th Amendment being... Because a lot of people, we were told in school, it was about, you know, black and white, it was about the Civil War. But it really is, it's about the class war, it's about working people. And look, it is one of the most important tools for working class voters in what is an ongoing fight against inequality, billionaire influence of our government, fascistic control by corporate America. This is really an important tool. And yeah, it was passed after the Civil War. It guarantees that all people, everyone born or naturalized in this country, no matter of race, gender, or background, are citizens entitled to equal protection under the law and due process. That's a big thing. That means that government cannot unfairly discriminate against anyone or strip any of our fundamental rights away without following the law. And look, for working class Americans, many who are in minority groups, marginalized groups, the 14th Amendment's the backbone for voting rights protections. It affirms that no state can pass laws to abridge our privileges, our rights, including the right to vote, including doing anything without due process or equal treatment. This amendment was critical, yes, in winning citizenship and voting rights for formerly black enslaved. It also helped dismantle legalized racial discrimination and did provide a constitutional basis to challenge voter suppression and unequal treatment. But understand, framing this as, well, that's back then, is, look, the battle's not over. Billionaire and corporate interests, they continue to fund massive campaigns into politics, into buying influence and pushing their voter suppression laws, which hurt working class voters. Understand, these restrictions that they keep throwing at us, like voter ID, a strict voter ID where you can only use certain ones, purging voters from voting rolls, limiting early voting, limiting the number of drop boxes, all of this stuff is designed to undermine the spirit of the 14th Amendment by denying equal access to the ballot. And understand, fighting back means using equal protection to protect our rights, push the courts, push lawmakers to uphold the right of everyone to vote. But this is why you're seeing this assault on the 14th Amendment. Understand, the amendment also safeguards our property, our liberty, and life from an illegal government overreach. Think this administration. It provides a legal framework to hold government officials accountable when they target working class communities like ours with their unjust policies. Without these protections, understand, the deck is stacked. The wealthy and the elite will get to exploit whomever they want, however they want. And also, while simultaneously silencing our voices. You know, in the big picture, the 14th Amendment is essential if we're going to fight and win the class war that's already underway. Billionaires aren't just donating to campaigns because they like it. They're not just funding think tanks because, oh, it seems like a thing to do. They're not funding all of these front groups with these wonderful names like Americans for Dogs and Puppies. They're not buying up the media for no reason. They're doing it to reshape laws and narratives in their favor. They're trying to swing the pendulum, as Anna Lilia pointed out, the Overton window. They're shifting in their direction. And it's time for us to realize that, you know, the 14th Amendment gives working class voters kind of a constitutional shield to demand some bit of fairness, some equality in a system that really, for most of us, seems rigged. It's not just a legal text. It's not just that boring thing we had to read in high school. It is a living promise. It is a living promise that despite the power and the money and the privilege that some have, it protects all of us. All Americans deserve equal rights, equal protection. Protecting and expanding these rights are crucial if the working class of this country wants to maintain any kind of a voice in what we are told is a democracy. If we're going to push back against corporate greed and corporate control, this is vital. And if we're going to build that more perfect union, a more just society, this, without it, understand, billionaires are just going to continue to buy up our government while the rest of us continue to feel left out and shut out. Why is it that every piece of legislation feeds the billionaire class, the already gorged? How is it possible when we have out-procreated the handful who control the money? Because again, it goes back to the messaging machine. Why'd they buy up all the radio stations? Why'd they buy up all the TV stations? Why'd they buy up all the newspapers? Because they want control of the narrative. They want to push their story. And they want it in your eyes and in your ears and in between your ears every minute of the day. It's amazing to me that this big, beautiful nonsense bill that they passed, we're not revolting over. You're talking about massive handouts to the very wealthy while taking from the least among us. And somehow we're a Christian nation. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Something I said got under your skin, under your on your nerves, made you happy, made you sad, angry. I want to hear it. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, check out the website. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A highly unusual face-to-face meeting. Ghislaine Maxwell, serving 20 years for sex trafficking, taken from federal prison to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tallahassee. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, President Trump's former personal attorney, conducting the meeting. It comes as the Trump administration faces mounting pressure to release the so-called Epstein files. President Trump visiting the Federal Reserve to get an up-close look at the building renovation that the president's criticized for being too costly.
There's always Monday morning quarterbacks. I don't want to be that. I want to help them get it finished. It's been going on for years. And I want to help him get it finished.
As he stood next to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, the president also put more pressure on Powell to lower interest rates. A loss for the world of professional wrestling. Hulk Hogan transported from his Clearwater, Florida home to the hospital where he died today after a serious medical issue. Hulk Hogan was 71. Wall Street, the Dow fell 316 points today. Dave Packer, ABC News. Texas State.